Live from CAP Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. Home care workers are responsible for some of the most vulnerable people who cannot live independently, from the elderly to the disabled and even children. For those who are low income, California's Medi-Cal-based program helps pay for at-home services instead of the alternative, which can range from nursing homes or boarding care facilities. There are tens of thousands of home care workers in Sacramento County alone, and for the better part of this year, they've been in contract negotiations with the county over better pay and extended health care benefits. Sacramento County home care workers currently make $16.50 per hour. Both the county and the union representing workers can't agree on a raise, but they're apart by less than a dollar per hour. CAP Radio healthcare reporter Kate Wolf has been following this and joins us with more. Good morning, Kate.
Good morning, Vicky.
When did you become aware of the issues surrounding home care workers in Sacramento County?
So earlier this year, I attended a press conference about a new legislative effort to get more collective bargaining power for home care workers. And I met some really impactful clients and workers. And one of the clients was an Oak Park resident named Russell Rawlings.
I moved to California 23 years ago from Texas and family because there are support systems such as in-home supported services, access to public transportation, accessible neighborhoods. None of these were present in the community that I was living in with my parents.
Rawlings is in a wheelchair and has cerebral palsy and sleep apnea, and he pretty much needs 24/7 care, which is extremely hard to find with wages being what they are.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, for those who haven't been touched by this personally, what are some other circumstances where a home care worker would be needed?
So home care is really for people who want to remain independent in their lives and oftentimes have people who love and care about them being their caretakers. And it's help with cooking, cleaning, eating, getting in and out of bed, going to the bathroom, handling medications. I mean, Russell is able to work. And he says none of that would be happening if he didn't have his home care worker able to get him out of the bed in the morning, right? That's crucial part. Last week, during an action held by Sacramento County workers, I met a woman named Sabrina Pike, who has been a caregiver for her friend, who's a diabetic amputee, and her friend's mother, who is very elderly and limited.
I'm constantly washing clothes, going to take people from doctor's appointments, getting medicine, going, you know, refilling stuff. I mean, I make all the phone calls. I do everything.
Yeah, that is a tremendous amount of work. Do you have any idea how many people are like Sabrina Pike, people who are working as home care workers in Sacramento or even the state?
So there are 30,000 home care workers in Sacramento and about 550,000 home care workers in all of California. So most of these folks, over 70% of home care workers, are women of color, and many of them are recent immigrants. And to give you an idea of the population that they serve, there are about 650,000 lower income, elderly and disabled people, including blind people in California, that get this type of care. And I want to add that, you know, in the next 40 years, the population of people over 65 in the U.S. is expected to nearly double, right? This estimation from between 2016 and 2060, the population is expected to double to about 94.7 million people in the United States that need this type of care. So this is really an industry that's going to need more and more home care workers over the next decades. And the trend does not seem to be increasing like that.
Yeah. I mean, this is on top of, I mean, just you laying out these numbers. I mean, as it stands today, there are currently more people in the state who get this type of care when compared to the number of workers in the state. You said there's 650,000 lower income elderly and people with disabilities that get this type of care, yet there's like 550,000 in California who are home care workers. So what are they asking for in Sacramento County?
So, yeah, I think you're exactly right, right? There is this discrepancy between the number of care workers and the people who need care. And a lot of the care workers that I talk to, they care for multiple people and have multiple clients around Sacramento that they go and assist. But I think what these workers specifically in Sacramento are asking for is a raise to, they currently make $16.50, as you mentioned. They want to raise to a little over $18. So they want $18.15. And they also want healthcare extended to more people. So currently, not everyone who's eligible for healthcare actually gets it. There's a wait list with about 1,100 people on it. And eventually, the union wants a $20 wage floor to attract and retain caregivers in the county.
So why haven't they been able to reach an agreement with the county?
The union that represents these workers, it's SEIU 2015, they say this is nothing new, right? It took 2 years to reach an agreement last time, and it's been almost a year now. They allege that the county is acting in bad faith. They say they're offering to meet in negotiations, but then not budging on their economic proposal. And their proposal, I'll say, is to raise the wage one more dollar to $17.50. And they also have suggested that they stop providing healthcare benefits at all and just add the money that they pay towards healthcare into the base pay, which would lift it even a little bit higher over the base pay that the union is asking for.
But even as like the wage that they're suggesting, $17.50 versus $18.15 an hour, I mean, we're talking about like 65 cents per hour. What does the county have to say about, you know, what the union is saying about their bad faith negotiations? Do they agree with that?
They don't agree with that. They say they are committed to coming to an agreement. They're trying to balance the needs of the workers with the economic reality of the overall budget. But I'd agree with you that it doesn't seem like a big difference in that base pay, but that this is how it is. Yeah.
And even given like their current hourly wage, even what they're asking for, you know, whether they agree on, you know, $17.50 an hour, $18.15 an hour, you know, that is just already tough to live on in Sacramento. What did you learn about how cost of living impacts them on a daily basis?
So it seems really, really hard. No one gets into this work to make money. I think oftentimes it's discovering that a close friend, a parent, a child needs care, and not being able to find any other seemingly appropriate options for them. But this, you know, the wage, as you said, is just impossible to live on in Sacramento. So the union did a survey and they found that a large portion of their providers, 61%, are unable to access medication because they can't afford the cost of prescriptions. 58 have had to skip doctor's visits because of financial concerns. 2/3 are rent burdened, meaning that they spend at least 50% of their income on housing. And 25% of home care workers, so a quarter of them, spend more than 75% of their income on housing. Lots of numbers there, but people are skipping medical appointments and people are feeling very stressed about rent and mortgage. So Sabrina Pike, who I mentioned earlier, she lives in Carmichael with her friend and her friend's mother. They share a 2-bedroom apartment and are only able to afford it on her wages and the Social Security of the two women. She was really upset about the equity adjustment the Sacramento Board of Supervisors gave themselves. If you remember, that boosted people's supervisors' base pay to $173 a month. Here's what she said.
Someday they're going to be old too. Don't they need someone to take care of them? I mean, everybody's going to need that someday. Don't you want someone to take care of you? I mean, otherwise, what is there? You end up in a nursing home and the county's going to have to pay for that someday. So why not get people that want to do it? Nobody wants to do this because it doesn't pay anything.
Yeah. And just to clarify, Kate, I mean, when you're talking about the Sacramento County Board of Supervisors, they approved to increase their salary to $173,000 a year, correct?
Yes. Sorry about that. Yes, a year.
Yeah. Well, at issue is not only pay, but there's also health care benefits that you touched upon. How does that work and what are they asking for?
So the county currently pays into a medical trust fund, and only a certain amount of these home care workers can get healthcare benefits. There's a wait list of about 1,100 people. And so the union is asking for the county to extend healthcare benefits to all of those people on the wait list.
Mm. And in your reporting, I mean, you reported that the county says only approximately 11% of caregivers that they currently use healthcare benefits that you're describing. Why is there such a discrepancy between caregivers that could use these benefits?
I am not totally sure about why that there is that discrepancy. I think people know that there's a wait list. So I think that's 11%. And then there are other people on a wait list. And Sabrina Pike says she's 700th on the wait list. She's been around 700. So she's still waiting to get that care. And she got care through Medi-Cal because everyone was able to get on Medi-Cal during the pandemic, or a lot of people who qualified were able to get and stay. But now that's unwinding. As you know, I've done some reporting on that. So she is really hoping to get on, you know, on this healthcare soon. But yeah, this is something I'd like to understand better. A lot of caregivers do get benefits another way. So either through a different job or through a family member, or they make little enough to qualify for Medi-Cal.
Hmm. We're talking specifically about Sacramento County, but is this a broader problem across Northern California or even the state?
So this is a broad problem throughout the state. The union is organizing in cities throughout California, Fresno, other spots in the Central Valley, down in LA. And Kim Yvonne is the executive vice president of SEIU Local 2015. And here's what she said to me about Sacramento County.
30,000 of the people who serve members of this county every single day are on the verge of homelessness, are on the verge of winding up in the emergency room themselves because they don't have access to health care, can't pay for their medication, are making decisions about whether putting food on the table or, you know, keeping a light on. That is a blight of this county and many counties in the state of California.
So what efforts are being made at the state level?
So currently, home care workers need to negotiate with the counties. It's really fractured a system, but there is an effort underway to have these workers, they're called IHSS workers or in-home supportive services workers, eventually negotiate with the state instead of county by county. So legislators approved a stakeholder work group that is going to provide recommendations to the governor in 2025.
Okay, so things are still in flux at the state level. Also, there are still negotiations going on in Sacramento County. Where do you see this going next, Kate?
So I checked back in with the union yesterday about where things stand with the county, and it's still stalled. It seems like it's going to be this way for a little while longer, but I think that the pressure is mounting for the county to act. There are more and more people going uncared for. These hours of care hours are being underutilized because people are leaving the profession, and more folks are going to need help.
Yep. Kate, thanks so much.
Thank you, Vicky.
Cap Radio healthcare reporter Kate Wolf is explaining why caretakers for elderly and disabled individuals in Sacramento are calling on the county to raise their wages and extend healthcare benefits for more people. Up next, in Silicon Valley, startup funding heavily flows to men, but a bill sitting on the governor's desk is looking to balance the scale in diversity. You're listening to Insight on your NPR station, Cap Radio. I'm Vicky Gonzalez.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, it's Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. We bring you in-depth, long-form interviews with actors, directors, musicians, authors, journalists, and more. Listen to our Peabody Award-winning Fresh Air podcast from WHYY and NPR.
You're listening to Insight here on Cap Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. Silicon Valley, home to tech giants and hub of the next digital frontier, AI. Despite the recent economic downturn, layoffs, and the failure of Silicon Valley Bank, The tech sector continues to attract billions of dollars in investments. According to PitchBook, a business data firm, California was home to 41% of venture capital funding in the United States last year. That equals out to over $102 billion. But who that VC money is being invested with is the topic of a new report, co-published by the Fuller Project, a global newsroom that focuses on women, along with The Guardian. Their data shows that just 2% of the money being invested by venture capital firms is flowing to companies founded by all-women teams. And for women of color, those numbers shrink even further. Hanisha Harjani is the reporter behind this story. Hanisha joins us to discuss the disparity in VC investing and a bill on the governor's desk that could help add transparency to who VCs invest in and potentially penalize those who don't share data. Welcome. Good morning.
Morning, Vicky. Thanks for having me on.
So let's start off with the Fuller Project, what it is and how you became involved with the nonprofit newsroom.
Yeah. So the Fuller Project is a global nonprofit newsroom that produces impactful journalism on issues affecting women. I'm currently employed there as a Poynter Koch Fellow through their fellowship program, and I'm working on the California desk. So, of course, Silicon Valley has been on our radar. And the interesting thing about Silicon Valley is that it might be local to California, but its influence is ultimately global.
Yeah,
it's a huge driver of the world economy. As you mentioned, more than $100 billion in venture capital funding flowed through the state in just 2022, and Silicon Valley made up about 70% of that. So when I first heard that only 2% of venture capital funding went to all women-led teams, that was really surprising to me. But I also knew that there were so many stories in the state that could be significant in highlighting how and why.
Yeah, overall, when it comes to California and how the state likes to present itself, you know, elected leaders in the state, California comes across as a progressive state, right? And a nation leader, as the governor would say. When it comes to this type of investment, venture capital funding, just 2% of the money going to all women teams, did you get a better understanding of why that's happening in Silicon Valley?
Yeah, so I did speak to some female founders for this story, and I heard a couple of reasons why there's such little representation for women and also people of color. First, it's just, I'm sure it's not a surprise, but Silicon Valley and venture capital are really insular worlds. These female founders I spoke to, they talked about how there is just an access problem. You really need to be connected to the right people to even get your foot in the door. So the chances are really bleak for the regular person on the street with a great idea to get funded. I also got the sense that this problem is kind of just vaguely known, and VCs are saying, you know, oh, we wish we could fund more people of color or more women, but there isn't that much being done to understand what exactly the barriers to access are, and nobody's really sharing their numbers or their efforts. So I think a law like this could do a lot to remedy that.
Yeah, I mean, well, it is receiving some awareness. I mean, it bubbled up to the state legislature, and there's a bill by State Senator Nancy Skinner, a Democrat that represents Berkeley, SB 54, that is now on the governor's desk and may be signed into law. What would this bill do if it becomes a new law?
Yeah, so SB 54 would require VC firms for the first time ever to disclose the demographic data of the founders they fund to the California Civil Rights Department. So this includes race, ethnicity, gender, sexuality, and their founders' disability and veteran status. It would apply to venture capital firms that are based in and have significant operations in the state, as well as those investing in California companies and soliciting investments from residents. So since venture capital is a huge industry in Silicon Valley, this would likely impact a lot of firms beyond Silicon Valley itself, to Wall Street and beyond. Additionally, this bill says that if companies refuse to disclose this information, it would empower the state to take these companies to court and penalize them for their noncompliance with fines. The bill also would empower the Civil Rights Department to potentially use the data provided to bring further civil action against VCs in the future as well.
Okay, so there would be accountability and consequences on the back end if they are not acting in good faith, and if that data shows that allows the state to act. On the front end, though, in terms of being proactive, what could this bill accomplish if this change isn't already happening within venture capitalist funding and who they choose to invest in?
Yeah, so this data we have access to, the numbers that we've kind of been quoting so far, that's been collected by third-party sources, and it's not been collected in any formal way. So we've never had this data in any official capacity before. So even knowing the actual statistics would be huge in starting to hold VC firms accountable. By getting this official information, for the first time ever, we would finally be able to see which firms are exclusively funding white men and which firms are expanding opportunities to other communities. Some of the folks I spoke with say that public pressure could be huge in getting VC firms to diversify their funding. And the threat of potential lawsuits is also something that could really motivate change. Mm.
Yeah. You spoke with a lot of people related to the tech industry. One of them was Ellen Powell. Ellen is the founder of Project Include, which helps tech companies with increasing their diversity. So let's hear a part of what she told you about why VCs need to disclose this data.
These horrible numbers and the lack of progress and even going backwards, it's coming from individual firms making biased decisions. And it's kind of like this general problem. Everybody knows there's a problem, but nobody feels responsible for it because everybody else has like bad numbers and we're not sharing any of those bad numbers. I think people have gotten comfortable there.
Mm. What else did Ellen tell you about the challenges of increasing the level of investment in women-led companies?
Yeah. So, you know, historically, venture capital has been disproportionately white and male in both the partners at the VC firms, as well as the founders of the companies that are funded. Powell previously worked as a venture capitalist, and she was one of the very few women of color partners in that space. And she called that experience really lonely. So Powell says that there's a tendency for VC firms to continue investing in the same communities of that their partners are representing. She really highlighted this comfort that's in this space and said that it's kind of the way that things have always been in this world. And there's nothing really pushing venture capitalists to seek out diverse founders because it's going outside of what and who they know.
Mm. Okay, if I'm someone that doesn't walk in the world of tech in Silicon Valley, can you give us a sense and help us visualize how this disparity that you're laying out in venture capital funding, how it manifests in real life?
Totally. I mean, we see it on the entrepreneurial level where, you know, who gets to start companies, who gets access to building wealth, that's kind of decided by who gets funded. We see it in the products that are available in the market and whose needs are met. And especially now, you know, with artificial intelligence completely transforming the way that we live and work, there's, you know, already been a lot of reporting on the ways in which AI reproduces discrimination that we see in real life. If, for example, we're funding AI companies that are not diverse, what will that mean for our future and the problems that are prioritized and the communities that are served by this incredibly powerful technology? For this story, we actually reached out to the 10 largest firms investing in AI. That included some giants in our neighborhood, like Sequoia Capital, Andreessen Horowitz, and Soma Capital, to name a few. We asked them for their thoughts on the bill and for the demographic information of their partners and the founders that they fund. However, not one of them would talk to us.
Okay. You also spoke with Marquesa Finch, and we're going to listen to her in just a moment about her detailing the struggles of female entrepreneurs. But first, tell us about her. How did you meet her?
Yeah, so Marquesa Finch helped draft the bill, and she's been very vocal about the disparity in VC funding. She's a fintech founder herself and also a venture capitalist with a decade of experience. She's also not a stranger to the bias in these industries. She said that in the past, she's been mistaken for support staff, and that when she pitches partners at venture capital firms who are almost always white and male, they pose questions that cast doubt on her ability to lead and perform, which she says is a stark contrast to her male counterparts who are often asked questions related to growth and potential. So she's experienced this discrimination firsthand and deeply feels the need for this transparency.
Hmm. Okay, well, let's take a listen to part of what she told you.
I think there's just a whole group of entrepreneurs that we're missing out on because they just can't even get in. That's where I hope we can take some of this work is really maybe in creating programs backed by our government to create nice little areas of opportunity for everybody.
Okay, so if this bill is signed into law, what are the biggest changes?
Yeah, so I mean, venture capital has been operating this way forever. There hasn't been anything holding them accountable for the way they fund. So this bill would kind of really create transparency in the industry that has historically been very, very closed off. And it could really change the face of it. Once this data becomes available, you know, in the same way that people can get sued for discrimination in housing and employment, that could be another way that VC firms are held accountable. When California's population is 50% women, when people of color make up over 60% of the state, why are we not seeing that data or anything close to it being represented in the VC world? Especially when you think about the fact that some of these VC firms are managing pension funds in the state, like CalPERS and CalSTRS. And those are some of the biggest funds in the country. And its members definitely consist of more than just 2% women. So ultimately, what this bill will do is by putting the data out there, venture capital can't deny that it has a problem anymore and kind of feign ignorance. And hopefully it will push them to change the status quo.
You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio, and we're speaking with reporter Hanisha Harjani with the Fuller Project about SB 54. It is a bill that would make California the first state to require venture capital firms that they disclose the race and gender of the founders of the companies that they fund. So at the core intention of this piece of legislation that may become a new state law is transparency, right? But there's also significant opposition to this bill, namely by the business community and advocacy groups like the California Chamber of Commerce. Can you unpack why they are opposed to this legislation?
Definitely. So the California Chamber of Commerce and TechNet wrote, and that's a national network of tech industry executives, they wrote an opposition letter together to the bill stating their concern that the data that comes out of the bill could be used in potential future lawsuits. The National Venture Capital Association also wrote an opposition letter and stated that they were worried about the financial risk that would be created as a result of the disclosure agreement. They also wrote that the legislation was unnecessarily punitive and lacks justification.
Was it easy or difficult to get in touch with them and get their to better understand their position on this?
You know, I did reach out to them all multiple times. However, none of the organizations that opposed the bill agreed to speak with me on the record. But just, you know, reading through the comments on the bill, there's a definite sense of this legislation being seen as bureaucratic overreach. They also talk about how the data collection process that's outlined here is inefficient and would require VC firms to undertake onerous administrative responsibilities. And they also said that they don't believe that this reporting requirement will meaningfully bridge this disparity in funding that we're seeing, which they say is a priority to them. But it is unclear to me what exactly their solutions are.
As you continue to look into it, and obviously with your in-depth reporting, did you get to potentially other main reasons why they would be opposed to this bill?
Yeah, I think there's a sense that this industry is really comfortable operating the way it has been, and this is a real change to that status quo. So I think there's a resistance to changing the way things have been, in addition to, you know, the threat of the lawsuits that could come about as a result of non-disclosure or potentially through the data that this bill produces.
And even potentially the threat of overregulation, right?
Definitely. I would say all of that. But, you know, I've also read reports from, you know, financial institutions and consulting groups that talk about the benefits of investing in minority-owned businesses. So I think there's definitely potential that the benefits of this bill go beyond just diversity. A report from 2018 showed that businesses founded by women delivered more than twice as much per dollar invested than businesses founded by men. And another report from that same year found that businesses owned by people of color are oftentimes more profitable and less risky investments.
Well, let's listen to Marquesa French on what she hopes the bill will accomplish.
Data collection around this issue will help us get a clear picture on a number of levels. But what it also does when it becomes now California policy, and then hopefully one day US policy, is that we can now start to build programs and other reinforcing initiatives around making sure that we do move the needle.
And Hanisa, you, I mean, in your report, you acknowledge this. I mean, outside of Silicon Valley, on a national level, there have been some pretty big efforts to turn back the promotion of diversity. I mean, in your reporting, you mention a recent Supreme Court ruling on school admissions, as well as a lawsuit against an advocacy group called the Fearless Fund. How does all of this relate to the topic that we're talking about?
Yeah, definitely. This bill is for sure coming at a time when there's a lot of backlash to diversity efforts across the nation. In fact, the people who helped strike down affirmative action in June are some of the very same people who are right now suing a venture capital firm in Atlanta, which you mentioned, Fearless Fund, that prioritizes funding Black women. The group pursuing this lawsuit argues that Fearless Fund's race and gender preference is illegal, though from the data that we have available, we know that Black women get less than 1% of venture capital funding. So I definitely think that this bill is coming at an important time in the national discussion around equal rights and policy. However, SB 54 is not mandating that VC firms fund in any specific ways. It's just requiring disclosure. And it's going to be really interesting to see how far just disclosure can get us, because transparency requirements like this could put pressure on VCs to diversify without explicit quotas. So in a way, it's kind of an alternative approach.
Any idea whether the governor will sign it or veto it?
That's a really good question. You know, I haven't really gotten a sense of how the governor will act. He does have until October 14th to sign or veto the bill. Nancy Skinner was previously quoted saying she was optimistic about the bill getting signed, but the governor's office wouldn't really give me a statement beyond saying that the governor evaluates the bill, like all measures, on its merits. So I guess we just have to wait.
If this is signed into law, when does the data reporting begin?
Yeah, so it would start on March 1st, 2025, and it would require VC firms to gather the demographic data of the year prior. So going forward, if this bill is signed into law on March 1st, 2025, and every year after that, VC firms would have to disclose that data then.
And if it becomes a law, it would be the first of its kind in the country, correct?
Correct. Yeah. And again, you know, Silicon Valley makes up a huge amount of the venture capital funding in the country. So even though it is a California law, its effects would ripple far beyond that.
Finally, Hanisa, what do you hope readers take away from your reporting? Even if they're not even involved or they don't even think about Silicon Valley, even though we are all touched by it.
Definitely. I think that's a really good point. You know, even though this world may seem kind of far away and distant to some of our listeners right now, it does very much influence the everything that we see happening in our lives, especially, I think, just emphasizing how transformative AI has been. Who gets funding to create the next generation of these products and services is really going to define how we live our lives, whether or not you are in the venture capital world or the tech world. So I think even having people know about this disparity is incredibly powerful, even if you're not a part of this world. And I think it's also important to think, you know, why are some of us feeling distant from this world? And could this bill help all of us feel maybe a little bit more aware of how capital is flowing and how that is affecting our material reality?
Well, thank you for the deep dive.
Thank you for having me on.
Hanisa Harjani is a reporter with the Fuller Project and co-published an article with The Guardian about the lack of venture capital firm funding in Silicon Valley for women-owned or led tech companies. You can read more of their report. We have a link posted right now on capradio.org/insight. Still ahead, for those who survive a brain injury like stroke, there can be a long road to recovery, both physically and emotionally. We'll learn about an event at Sac State for stroke survivors, their care partners, and those who work in the medical field. You're listening to Insight here on Cap Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. We're back in just a moment. Welcome back to Insight on Cap Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. Stroke touches many of us. It is a leading cause of death in the United States. But for those who survive this brain injury, there can be a long road to recovery, and that is both physically and emotionally. As with most hardships, there isn't really a handbook to overcome something that is so personal because each stroke is different. Luckily, though, there is support to regain one's capabilities and identity. On Saturday, October 7th at Sacramento State, the campus is hosting an event for stroke survivors, their care partners, and those who work in the medical field. The distinguished speaker is Dr. Deborah Meyerson, founder of the nonprofit Stroke Onward and author of the book Identity Theft, Rediscovering Ourselves After Stroke. Dr. Meyerson is joined by Flannery O'Neill, a stroke survivor and executive director of Stroke Onward, as well as Deborah Gonzalez, a speech pathologist who runs a stroke support group here in Sacramento. Good morning and welcome to all of you.
Good morning.
Thank you.
Good morning.
A pleasure. Okay, so Deborah Gonzalez, I want to start with you. We have two Deborahs in this conversation. I want to start with you because this segment really begins with you. You reached out to us. You wanted to raise awareness about stroke recovery and your speech pathologist who also hosts a support group here in Sacramento. How did you become so involved in stroke recovery and support?
Well, in fact, the group that I lead was not initially intended to be a support group. I intended it for it to be a communication group, a safe place where people with communication disorders can, you know, practice talking and practice their skills. But as the word got out about the group, it quickly morphed into what I would consider to be a support group. I really just facilitate it and all the group participants lead it. And I just make sure everybody gets a chance to talk. And what I learned from the group is that, you know, stroke recovery isn't about walking and talking.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, it's Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. We bring you in-depth, long-form interviews with actors, directors, musicians, authors, journalists, and more. Listen to our Peabody Award-winning Fresh Air podcast from WHYY and NPR.
It's about who am I now since my stroke? What are my support groups? What are my challenges? And also care partners are also part of the group.
Mm. And a big part of your pitch was Dr. Meyerson. When did you become connected and aware of her work?
So I can't remember which came first. I saw a story from last summer about Stroke Onward's cycling across the United States. And I'm a cyclist myself, so that really intrigued me. And so I started following them. And then our group collectively read her book. And so each we meet twice a month. So we would talk about a chapter or two each month. And that was just that sold me.
All right, Dr. Meyerson, that brings me to you. You are a tenured Stanford professor, a wife, a mother of three children, and you suffered a severe stroke that just profoundly changed your life. You know, on your bio, you write that it nearly killed you. You were paralyzed on your right side with no speech at all. But you spent 3 years fighting to regain independence, and you turned all of that personal adversity into a nonprofit to help others. So I would love to start with your organization and you telling us about Stroke Onward.
3 years after my stroke, I wrote Identity Theft. Then Steve and I started Stroke Onward. Steve is my husband. And the emotional and identity is so underplayed. The medical model is so dominant. Chronic disability is so not treated well.
Yeah. You know, and Deborah, bringing you in, because you read Dr. Meyerson's book. I mean, obviously, you find her so inspiring, and not only that, it transcends your support group as well.
Absolutely. I mean, I say I've been a speech pathologist for 32 years. My group has met for 7 years, and I've learned more from these stroke survivors and their partners than, you know, anyone could have taught me in school. And I agree, the medical model is overwhelming, and it needs a lot of area to grow.
Mm. Flannery, I want to bring you in because you work very closely with Dr. Meyerson at Stroke Onward. You are a survivor yourself of stroke. How did your life experience connect you with this mission?
You know, I was fortunate to learn about Stroke Onward and about Deborah and Steve a couple of years ago. And after surviving my stroke, really wanted to take my personal experience and my background in health and public health and try to change the system. And that's what we're trying to do at Stroke Onward is really ensure that the general public understands that emotional recovery from stroke is an integral process for all of us who have been impacted by stroke. It's integral to our full recovery. We need our support from the medical model to get us back on our feet, to get us through physical therapy, occupational, speech, but emotional recovery and emotional support is as important as those other pieces. And so when I learned about the work they were trying to do, it was incredible because I was trying to do that myself mm-hmm. through support groups, but this is taking it to a much broader level so that we can really, we seek to that everyone who is touched by stroke has access to the emotional recovery resources and support that they need to rebuild their life in the way that they.
Yeah, and people may be surprised to learn, Flannery, that you experienced a stroke in your 30s. And I think in that spirit, what are some of the biggest unknowns or misconceptions about surviving a stroke?
I think that is one of them is just that stroke can happen at any age. I knew something was happening, very serious was happening when I was having a stroke. But it took a while for my brain to understand that I was having a stroke because I always had attributed that to an older adult disease. But in fact, it can happen to us at any point. It's so important to know that you're not alone when you're in this journey, when you are impacted by stroke, a brain injury, and other traumatic illnesses, that it can feel very isolating. And what can be really meaningful in your recovery is connecting with other people who are going through the same issues. And why Deborah Gonzalez, you know, talked about her group and how people are really, we need connection and we need connection to our therapists and our health professionals, but also to one another who are walking down that same road.
Yeah, I mean, Deborah, I imagine you had a front row seat to kind of dismantling these unknowns and misconceptions when it comes to suffering a stroke, not only for survivors, but for caregivers, those who love these people as well.
That's right. I mean, again, the medical model has this myth, and Deborah talks about it in her book, too, that the first 6 to 12 months are where you're going to get the most recovery. Well, I've been running this group for 7 years, and in those 7 years, we've seen people go from wheelchair to walking. We've seen people get their driver's license back. In fact, that's a very popular topic of conversation in our group is driving in the DMV. And when we get somebody new to the group, everybody has a chance to sort of retell their stroke story, and that's always the most powerful day.
Yeah. Dr. Meyerson, I mean, that was you. I mean, you detail 3 years of recovery to regain that independence. You even mentioned, you know, being able to drive and your driver's license as well.
Yeah.
You touched upon your book, Identity Theft. What do you hope readers take away from your personal experience of surviving with a stroke?
The identity is so important, and grief, the aphasia is, I am aphasic, and I am really trying to, 13 years after my stroke. And I am really the really the family is and care partner is so important, and help meaning and purpose is so important.
Absolutely. I mean, Dr. Meyerson was talking about aphasia. Flannery, can you explain what that is for someone who isn't aware?
Yes. So aphasia is a very common communication disorder that occurs in strokes, in about 30% of strokes, but it also can occur in other brain injuries and brain disorders. And so Deborah has aphasia, and that can impact our ability to say the words that we want to say. And also sometimes it can affect our ability to understand when other people are speaking to us. I also have aphasia, and my aphasia is different than Deborah's and affects me differently. And it can be a real spectrum of how it impacts people. But it does not in any way indicate that there's a loss of intelligence. It is purely a communication disorder. But our intelligence is intact. It is just harder for us to access our dictionary or our vocabulary. And so that is it. It's one of the true challenges in stroke recovery, among many. But for those of us with aphasia, that can be a huge impact to our identity. And so I really am thankful for Deb for being willing to be a spokesperson and to speak out about this, because it is very hard, especially when you're living with aphasia.
Yeah, I mean, Flannery, given that you are living with this as well, I mean, at the root of this that Dr. Meyerson is talking about is a change in identity, you know, who we were before stroke and who we are after. How did you navigate that as someone who has survived a stroke yourself?
So I have to laugh a little bit, because I navigated this whole journey without realizing that what I was struggling with was identity until I read Deborah's book several years later. So I really leaned heavily on family and friends. And then at the time I was living in a small town with no access to a peer support group. And so I decided to put one together so that I could meet some other people. And so connecting with peers in, whether it is in an in-person group, whether it is a Facebook group, there are lots of different ways, even listening to podcasts, reading books. There are so many ways to read other people's stories, and really that has helped me a lot in kind of rebuilding who I want to be and understanding what it's like to live a full life after you've had an illness like stroke.
Dr. Meyerson, if someone is just in the thick of it right now, going through this, a stroke or a brain injury, and this conversation resonates with them, what advice do you have for someone who is going through the emotional journey in recovery?
Choice is really, choice is so important, and I am multiple identities. I sometimes I really I am going to shock, or sometimes it's a lot of multiple identities.
Absolutely. Deborah Gonzalez, I want to end with you, because it started with you and it's not over yet. There is an event this Saturday at Sacramento State. What would you like people to know for those interested in attending? We have about 30 seconds left.
Well, it's at Folsom Hall. It's sponsored by the Center for Health Practice Policy and Research, or CHPR program. You can come at 10 a.m. for registration and a free breakfast. And then Dr. Meyerson and her husband are speaking until about 11:30. And from 11:30 to 1, we're having a health fair.
Well, thank you so much, Deborah, Dr. Meyerson, and Flannery, for just such an important conversation.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
And that is Dr. Deborah Meyerson, founder of the nonprofit Stroke Onward and author of the book Identity Theft: Rediscovering Ourselves After Stroke. Flannery O'Neill is a stroke survivor and executive director of Stroke Onward, and Deborah Gonzalez is a speech pathologist who runs a stroke support group here in Sacramento. We have more information for the event on Saturday at Sacramento State on our Insight page. And that is it for Insight today. You can learn more about our guests at capradio.org/insight. You can also subscribe to the Insight podcast. If you want to join the conversation, shoot us an email, insight@capradio.org. I'm Vicky Gonzalez. Thanks for joining us. Have a great day. We'll catch you back here tomorrow.
Hi, it's Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. We bring you in-depth, long-form interviews with actors, directors, musicians, authors, journalists, and more. Listen to our Peabody Award-winning Fresh Air podcast from WHYY and NPR.